much the observing nature of humans as the acting nature of humans that is relevant here. Often in physics, because we're trying to pretend that we're objective and we stand outside the system, we imagine we just observe, but it's also true that we do stuff, and that may be important also. So first of all, I'm going to talk a bit about general issues to do with consciousness and Turing type tests. And this is very much a physicist's take on these issues, so I should apologize in particular to philosophers in the audience for the sort of lack of subtlety. But let me just begin with prelude, accounting for consciousness. So there are three basic types of ontological account. In addition, there's idealism, which may be ontological, but it's of a different flavor. Here are the three types of account. So we have those accounts which have only matter. I've got two columns here. I've got only matter and then mind added. And then here I've got that there's no fundamental property corresponding to consciousness. And then we have some fundamental property corresponding to consciousness. So the first one is just straightforward materialism. So consciousness is somehow emergent out of this this picture. So one example of straightforward materialism would be the standard model of elementary particles. Of course, we could take something different. It doesn't have to be this particular example, but you can see here, although you have all these properties, none of these properties are consciousness. It's not put in there at the beginning. There's no consciousness boson or something. And then the idea of the account you'd want from this would be of consciousness would be somehow it was emergent, and those kinds of accounts face the David Chalmers hard problem. How do you account for the fact of experience out of this sort of picture? Things like experience of the color red, or experiences like happiness or joy. So the next one is when you now add something. So still materialism, you still have only matter, but there's some fundamental property of matter corresponding to consciousness. So here's a sort of picture of it. So you have the world, the whole universe. This is just a part of the universe, of course. So here's some small part of the universe, but what I'm saying applies to the entire universe. And then the entire universe has this sort of property added, a kind of glitter, if you like, that corresponds to consciousness. And so everywhere in the entire universe has this property. And of course, this would be especially salient when you're around humans, and other animals perhaps, but nevertheless, it is spread out everywhere. And that is how you account for consciousness. So the third kind of account is mind-matter duality. And that's the thing I'm especially interested in this talk. So this is where you have matter, ordinary matter, but then you add mind. Okay, so this goes back to Descartes. And here's a picture so I don't understand how this picture represents the idea of mind-matter duality, but it's taken from his treatise on the subject. In any case, the idea is that there's the sort of ordinary matter, and then in addition to that, there's some sort of non-physical mind added, and you need that mind to have consciousness. So one problem with especially with the mind-matter duality approach, and the same would apply also perhaps to the panpsychism. Let's focus on the mind-matter duality case. This argument that it would have to be the conscious mind would have to be epiphenomenal. So the argument usually goes like this: well, physics is sort of causally closed, and so if there is mind, it really just has a passive observing role, and it's not it doesn't change things in the world. Because if it did change things in the world, you'd get into trouble with energy conservation and so on. I don't think it's a terribly great argument personally, Because, you know, if we're going to make big changes to physics to account for consciousness, then why do we care about energy conservation and things like that? You know, we're perfectly willing in this building and, you know, other buildings of similar sorts to entertain making radical changes to physics. And the thing we want to account for is something really important, like consciousness. So I don't think we need to worry about that. But it's an argument that's very is very much there in the literature. And so here's an empirical argument against epiphenomenalism. If you look in a dictionary, you'll find the word consciousness. So this argument, incidentally, comes from my PhD supervisor, Ewan Squires. He wrote a book called Conscious Mind in the Physical World. So if you look in the dictionary, you'll find the word consciousness in black ink, assuming you have a dictionary that uses black ink. And so that means that the ink atoms must have been influenced, presumably indirectly, by whatever is responsible in the ontology for consciousness. Okay, it's difficult to imagine sort of atoms appearing in that configuration. And of course, this word has semantic meaning, and it's used consistently among different among humans in accord with the meaning that it has. It's difficult to imagine the particular atoms getting into that configuration. In S, whatever it is that's responsible in the ontology for consciousness somehow was involved in making those atoms move to be in that position. So when I was preparing these slides, I gave the shortened version of this talk last week at a conference called The Science of Consciousness. It was a very broad audience, so the slides sort of represent that. So I asked my wife to take a photograph of a dictionary, just to illustrate, you know, the black ink in the dictionary in that configuration. And because we've been painting our house, all our dictionaries were in a box. The only one we had free was the Scrabble dictionary. So we looked in the Scrabble dictionary, and if you look, it goes from Conquian, which is a card game. I don't know what that card game is, to consent. But the word consciousness, and even the word conscious, is missing. So that seems to imply that Scrabble players are zombies. Anyway, since the word consciousness does appear in good dictionaries, we conclude that the behavior of matter can be affected by ontological elements responsible for consciousness. So from the Cartesian dualist point of view, my matter point of view, we can tell a story in which the mind acts on the brain and thereby imparts information, you know, through the arms and legs and whatnot into the physical world. And somewhere down the line, that might lead to the certain configurations of ink in a dictionary. That means that atoms inside the brain, in this Cartesian point of view, would have to violate the regular laws of physics. So you could attempt to look for that. You could attempt to get a big microscope and look inside the brain at the atoms and see if they're behaving in a way that violates the laws of physics. But that would be really difficult to do. The brain is a very messy environment. It would be difficult to get a few quantum degrees of freedom that were isolated so that you were certain that they were behaving, you know, that you could look at their behavior. And even if you did, you might not be completely confident that you found evidence of consciousness. It might just be some sort of new physics, and you might find the same behavior somewhere else. So this would be a very difficult experiment to imagine doing. But maybe we can do a different sort of thing. So Turing had a very different sort of idea. So Turing, I think, was trying to come up with evidence against things like mind-matter dualism. And if you read his paper, it's a very open-minded paper. He discusses all sorts of different things in that paper. It's in the end, he was trying to come up with an argument against dualism. But the form of his argument is interesting for our purposes. So everyone, I'm sure, knows this. So the idea is you have a subject. So you have an interrogator and then a screen. And then the interrogator can only talk via a computer link-up, and either with a subject or with some AI system. and the interrogator asks, types questions, and the subject, the human or the AI system, give responses. And then after a prolonged period of discussion, the interrogator has to say whether or not they think it's a human or an AI system. So the basic form of this type of test, I want to talk about a broader category of Turing type tests. The basic form is that you have some boxes. These are figurative boxes that you put people in. So the particular boxes I've drawn here are maybe a bit small, at least uncomfortable for people. But you can imagine, well, these are only figurative boxes, so you don't have to use actual boxes. And then you may have more than one box. So in the Turing test, you only interview one person, but you could expand that to interviewing many people. Maybe that's a different challenge. And likewise, you may have more than one box. And then the important thing is that you only allow classical information to flow in and out of the box. So if real people can do something that artificial devices cannot do, then we have evidence for mind-matter duality. Conversely, if in every situation you try, artificial devices can simulate real people or can do the same things that real people can do in this situation, then you have evidence against anything like mind-matter duality. Okay. Okay, quantum entanglement. Okay, bell type tests. So remember, this slides were prepared for a different audience. So Bell experiment, everyone knows this. You have some source, particles go out, you make measurements each end. And then you have a setting, setting A, end A, setting B, end B, and the setting has to be chosen by something. Okay. You assume locality, so assume that the outcome at end B doesn't depend on setting A, and vice versa. And then you can show that the Bell correlation, you know, the usual Kazahorn-Shimini-Holtin correlation is less than or equal to 2. Quantum theory gives you 2.8. So it seems like one end knows what the setting at the other end is. It's the usual argument. So it's important in doing these experiments to impose locality conditions. The idea is, you know, you perform a switch. And you have to do it in such a way that if you make the switch at a certain time, then information about what the setting is after that switch shouldn't have been able to reach the other end. And you have to do that in both directions. So in the actual experiments that have been done, the switching is usually done by a random number generator. In the other experiment, there was no switching. In more recent experiments, the switching has been done by a random number generator. There's been one experiment where the switching was done by photons coming from a distant star, or distant stars on each side of the apparatus. Mostly it's random number generators. And so the worry about random number generators is that maybe they are actually really a random number generator is a deterministic machine. There's no way of knowing that fundamentally that isn't the case. So if it were a deterministic machine, then it would have some hidden state. And from that hidden state, you can predict the future state. So it would be possible to send the earlier state and broadcast it to the other end. You send it earlier, and so that information would reach the other end so the other end could know what the actual setting was going to be. Okay, so the information, if in the case that the random number generator is deterministic, the information can easily be at the other end. That's clear, I think. Yeah. Okay, using humans. If the interventions of mind on matter cannot be anticipated in the sort of way that I was just talking about, so in this slide, this side can sort of anticipate what the setting is going to be by looking at the earlier state. It can work out by looking at the earlier state. But if these switches coming from humans cannot be anticipated, then they introduce sort of in some sense genuinely new information then it would be possible to impose the causality, the locality conditions. So each end you'd have a switch, and then information about the switch, the new setting, would spread out at the speed of light or less. And if you arrange things properly, then you could be sure that neither end would be able to know the setting at the other end. So then you would be truly, under this kind of way of thinking, you would be truly imposing the locality conditions. So this isn't so much about freedom of choice. I mean, you might think that this, so obviously this has a bearing on the issue of free will, but from the point of view of this, what's more important is that these interventions come from outside, so that you have sort of the physical, you know, the world of matter, the physical world, and then you have sort of in this dualistic picture, you have interventions from outside that aren't built into the sort of into this material level of description. And so, you know, it's conceivable that the mind itself is subject to its own deterministic laws, and you still have this kind of phenomena. So it doesn't. Some interesting empirical results in this case wouldn't necessarily prove that you had free will, although it would be strong evidence in that favor. But it's more about this notion of intervention. And yeah, please.
So in a sense, this would be the inverse of the approach in the Turing test, no? Want to see,
yeah, exactly,
something looks like a human and you hide it. In this case, you say put the human there. So
yeah.
Whatever I believe about humans.
Yeah, so I'm coming very much to that. Yeah. So far, of course, no experiments have been done with humans. It's interesting because often, people often speak when they talk about the experiments, you know, where you get people at each end to make the settings to the settings, but no one's actually done that because it's very difficult. And maybe also no one thought it was really necessary, you know, because it should be sufficient to use a random number generators. But in this picture, it would be necessary. So this is sort of what Julie was just saying. So you have either this situation, we have a human at each end compared with an AI system at each end. An AI may now stand for artificial interventions. You know, so random number generators might be the things that you believe would be able to artificially intervene, perhaps some other kind of machine. And so, just as Julie was saying, this is a Turing type test. So instead of having just one person in a box, as in the Turing test, you know, you need two boxes. But that's a perfectly reasonable generalization of this Turing sort of test. And you put these artificial devices, either random number generators or humans or something else, into the boxes, and you see what happens. And just like Julio said, it sort of does the opposite to the Turing test. Whereas Turing was trying to prove there was no such thing as mind-matter duality, this would give you evidence in the opposite direction. Of course, the most likely outcome is that you see quantum theory continues to be satisfied, and so that continues to provide evidence for some kind of evidence for lack of mind-matter duality in the context of local theories. Okay. So that's the basic sort of idea, the Gedanken experiment. Of course, this experiment here would be very difficult, would be difficult to do, and it wouldn't really work like this. So let me go on to an actual proposed experiment. So first of all, this first, I gave a talk in the US last week, and this picture went down especially well. People weren't scared at all. So you could either imagine having human inputs. So that's where you could imagine a situation where you have where the human inputs are just somebody pressing a button. So you know, you press button one or button two, whatever they are, and you choose the setting that way. But there's these experiments where people have shown that just from the EEG signals, you can predict 1/10 of a second earlier what choice someone is going to make. They've done this in the context of typing, for example. You know, if someone's typing on a typewriter, they can predict with high accuracy, like in the 90% or higher, accuracy what letters someone's going to press 1/10 of a second earlier. So in 1/10 of a second, you know, a light speed signal could travel several times the diameter of the Earth. You couldn't perform an experiment on planet Earth and impose the locality conditions like this. It's just wouldn't be feasible. So the idea instead is to use the EEG signals directly. Okay, so you take them from the brain. So according to one source, I read that these electrical signals travel through the brain at near light speed, because the brain is pretty much water. And so, an electrical signal that's generated anywhere in the brain should travel to the skull pretty much at light speed. And then from there, you can convey it to the setting on the apparatus very quickly. Someone I spoke to last week said that this wasn't true. Actually, it travels more like at sound speed, so you would incur more delay. So I need to talk to some neuroscientists and experts on this and find out what really is the case. But in any case, even that, since the radius of the brain is not so big, it wouldn't be such a problem. Sound is still a lot faster than mechanical. In the case of pressing a button, you have mechanical speeds, so it's very slow. And for the sort of size of experiment I'm looking at, this should still be okay. So you use the EEG signals directly. And then the idea is you need to get sufficiently high statistics. So you need to have a sufficiently high fraction of cases where the setting has been changed at each end and there hasn't been time for a signal to reach the other end. So you can increase your statistics by having many more people, each and not just one person, but many people. They're all wearing these EEG headsets. You can imagine that they're Bluetooth enabled. So they send the signal goes from there to some local relay station, and then from the relay station back onto the setting to change the setting. And you do this at each end. One of the advantages of this is that used the famous hockey stick, couldn't I? One of the advantages of this is that these people could be in a sort of populated towns. In cities, you have good access to people. Whereas this here could be, up on a mountain or someplace where light can travel through the atmosphere without a great distance. And this signal is transmitted from here to here at the speed of light. So as long as this town is on the other side of this station from here, then you're not incurring any extra delay. You transmit these by radio signals. And indeed, transmission, the random number signal was transmitted by radio signal in the Canary Islands experiment that Zeilinger's group did. So this sort of technology is already being used. So you have 100 people or so wearing EEG headsets at each end. You transmit the signal. You have to do some appropriate processing of the signal, which would have to be ultra fast, and this is something that I'm thinking about at the moment. And then you choose the setting based on that signal, and likewise over here. If we have 100 people at each end, and so originally in this paper I suggested doing it over a distance of about 100 kilometers, because that's comparable with the distance used in the Canary Island experiment. Then if you assume that you have each person can switch at a rate of 10 hertz, 100 people, distance of 100 kilometers, then the locality conditions will be met in about 1% of cases. So you see an effect that was about 1%. Which would be just about big enough to see a significant effect. So I published this result in May of 2017. So I want to talk about the beginning of an actual collaboration. It's very much nascent, but we're just starting to talk about an actual experiment. And this is with these people in China, Zhanwei Pan and his group. I've been talking in particular with Yuan Yin, who is the first author on this paper. So I'm sure many of you have seen this paper. This is it's published in July 2017. And this is a satellite-based entanglement distribution experiment over 1,200 kilometers, which is incredible. The way it works is there's a satellite source of pairs of photons that are seen through telescopes on the ground. Yeah, so that's the experiment. And they saw a significant violation of Bell's inequalities in this experiment. So the team consists of Yanwei Han, various other people, and this is Yuan Yin, who I've been talking with a lot over email and also some Skype call. The satellite was launched in August 2016. These slides, of course, were provided by the group in China. This is a diagram of the satellite. So I guess I don't understand most of these labels. This must be the GPS. Oh, there's also GPS here. Anyway.
Is that the one that Vienna is involved in, Zeiligen and so on?
They've done some work with the Vienna group as well. Using this satellite, they did something. I haven't fully understood that paper yet because it was then between China and, you know, but I don't think it was straightforward entanglement shared between the two, but maybe some sort of relay station or something.
It's probably that satellite there.
Anyway, so here's a picture. So this is what happens. The satellite goes around the planet once a day. Actually, I think the satellite is in a a sun synchronous orbit. So I guess that means it just stays fixed. Doesn't make sense. Anyway, the satellite goes around our planet once a day. So for 90 seconds, it's in the right position for them to see photon pairs being received at this satellite and this satellite. And they see about one pair per second. So you're getting about 90 events every second. So the proposed experiment is now near to two of these towns, these places, you get 100 people wearing the EEG headsets. Sounds a little bit crazy. Transmit the thing to their appropriate processing of the electrics, of the signals, choose the setting, and then see what happens. And so according to a naive, a sort of straightforward analysis of this, with these numbers, 1,200 kilometers, 100 people at each end, and a 10 hertz switching per person, you could expect to see the locality conditions are satisfied in close to 100% of cases. Now, the biggest unknown here is this one, 10 hertz. And you sort of imagine that you can sort of press a button 10 times a second, but that may be wrong. And of course, even if it were true that there was some sort of mind matter duality, which is already something people would be skeptical about, to really know what the frequency was would be very difficult. So I need to spend more time talking with experts in neuroscience to get some sort of understanding of what this might be, what the likely candidates are for EEG signals. There's all sorts of concerns there. So this is perhaps a little bit naive, but it gives you some idea of how the distance helps you. This big distance really helps in terms of seeing a big effect. Okay, so now let's ask the question. No matter how unlikely you think this is, that we would actually see, the effect we're talking about here is where you start to see a violation of quantum theory in the direction of Bell's inequalities being satisfied. If you had 100% locality conditions being imposed, then you'd expect to see the Bell inequalities satisfied. Otherwise, you'd expect to see something between the 2.8 of quantum theory and the 2 of locality being satisfied. And of course, the other thing is, of course, you can easily do control in these kinds of experiments because you could do things like record the electrical signal going into the switch, and then just play it back again on a different day exactly the same signal into the apparatus and see if you see if you still see the violation of quantum theory. Okay, so control is something that you can do quite easily. So if under appropriate controls you still you see an effect where quantum theory is violated, how would we interpret that? Okay, so what if quantum theory were violated in this experiment in accord with the Bell inequalities? So first of all, the consequences for physics, for quantum foundations in particular, but really for physics as a whole, would be very significant. So this would prove that we had locality, contrary to all the everything we thought. Also, and perhaps this is more disturbing, it would show that we had a kind of superdeterminism, you know, that because that would, it would mean that the explanation for why we had seen a violation of Bell's inequalities in all the existing experiments would be that somehow, you know, the outcome at NB was influenced by the earlier setting of the earlier state of the of what was happening at end A. So that would be and so you would have this kind of superdeterminism of a sort that I think a lot of people, including myself, find distasteful. It's interesting, incidentally, that the de Broglie-Bohm model, which is completely deterministic, doesn't have this kind of superdeterminism. In the case where your quantum state factorizes in the de Broglie-Bohm model, then you don't have non-locality instantaneous sort of signaling. If there's entangled state between the two sides, you do. But if the state factorizes, then you don't. And we're kind of, we're considering a situation in which the switching factorizes between the two ends. Okay, so it'd be important, obviously important consequences for physics, but these consequences would pale into insignificance compared with the importance for the study of mind. And this will be very strong evidence for Cartesian duality, you know, because it's exactly this Turing-type test that we talked about before. Although, if we actually saw this effect, then I think there would be a lot of debate as to what the real meaning was. You could imagine other types of explanation. So here's an alternative sort of explanation you might try to set up. You might say, well, but the switching has to be performed by sufficiently complex machines in order to see this effect. And it's only when the machine is complex in the right way that you start to see quantum theory being violated. And in particular, that's the kind of complexity you see in human brains. You know, maybe you could simulate it in other machines, although that would be very difficult because there's not much around that is as complicated as a human brain. The problem with that kind of explanation is that you know, since you have locality, you'd expect to have sort of microphysical laws that were local. And then if you just took a few atoms you know, that were inside the brain, they should really behave in the same way as a few atoms that were outside the brain. And so if you just taken a signal from these few atoms, it's so difficult to imagine this kind of complexity-based explanation for this result. So although I think there would be debate on either side, this will be the kind of strong evidence, a sort of smoking gun evidence for Cartesian duality. So I think it would push the debate in a way. Of course, this is all what if. Very unlikely we actually see this result, but it's worth considering. One thing that's worth mentioning here is that, you know, a lot of the debate concerning consciousness in quantum foundations is about the measurement problem. And there's been a long history of thinking about mind-matter duality in quantum foundations. So Wigner talking about the wave function causing collapse. There's something called the many minds interpretation, which is a variant on the many worlds interpretation, where minds are invoked to make sense of the interpretation. Many people say that the Copenhagen interpretation is dualist. So Jizan wrote a paper recently where he said the Copenhagen interpretation is dualist. So many people have talked about invoking mind-matter duality consciousness in the context of the measurement problem. Here we have a different flavor. It's not about the measurement problem. It's about providing switching. So it's actually, rather than being on the observer end, it's on the acting end of what we expect humans to do. So this idea, I first had this idea to use humans to switch the settings, you know, 30 years ago when I was still an undergraduate, and then I wrote up two papers. So this paper, you see, I've redacted my home address. I wrote these up in 1989, and this one I wrote before I even started my PhD. This one I wrote once I'd started my PhD with Ewan Squires. I chose to work with him instantly because I was interested in these issues. And obviously, I submitted this paper for publication, but of course, you know, they weren't published in the physical review. A wasn't going to accept papers like this. Though interesting, here's a diagram from the first paper I wrote, and here's sort of people with the sort of, you know, the EEG signal being taken into the upper. This is the sort of experiments that were done, you know, in the early days. This is the sort of diagrams that people had for these experiments in the early days. Here's a polarizing crystal. This is a switch that switches into this measurement apparatus or this one, likewise over here. And the idea is that you switch either into this apparatus or this one using this signal from the brain. But it's satisfying that to think, you know, this kind of experiment might now be possible. So this idea was mentioned by my supervisor in his book here. This is a nice book, actually. It's hard to get a copy, but so he mentioned the idea that I was talking about here. So interesting, at the end he says, experiments along these lines would be precise tests of a well-defined type of dualism. Unfortunately, the timescales involved suggest that they would be very difficult to perform. And so that was certainly true when he wrote his book in 1990. John Bell, in his paper, La Nouvelle Cuisine, sort of mentions the idea very much in passing, and it's not clear he's actually being serious. He was often very, tongue-in-cheek in his papers. So he says, sorry, this is a bit small. We can imagine these settings being freely chosen at the last second by two different experimental physicists or some other random devices. So it suggests that he wasn't really thinking of humans and random devices as being on different footings. And he didn't discuss the issue of mind. And if you read that paper, it seems that he wouldn't have taken that sort of seriously. So three things have changed in the last 30 years. First of all, you're laughing because attitudes have changed. Okay, first of all, attitudes have changed. Now I think people are far more likely to take this sort of thing seriously. And indeed, it looks like we're beginning to get some experiment going. Secondly, contrary to what Ewan, my supervisor, said 30 years ago, now an experiment is just about feasible. That's fantastic. It's remarkable, really, to imagine back then that you might have been able to perform get entanglement over 1,200 kilometers. It would have just been inconceivable. And of course, I'm in a much more secure situation. I can say this kind of thing, and maybe we'll still have a job. Incidentally, the second paper, I wrote the first paper, and I gave it a very boring title, and I hoped that nobody would notice it. And then I thought, at least I've published this. This is the 2015 paper. And then one person who did notice it was Mike Lazaridis, who is the chair of the board at Perimeter, and indeed the person who gave the initial donation that provides the endowment for this institute, got the institute going. He bumped into me in the corridor one day and he said, I liked your paper. Which one? He said, this one. And he said, we had a conversation. He said, well, you should write a proposal. So that's the reason I wrote the second paper. So it seems that this is, you can get away with this kind of research. Back then, 30 years ago, I was pretty confident, a little bit crazy. I was pretty confident that if you did this experiment, a positive result would be seen. You know, as you get older, the rough edges wear off, and by now I think it's far less likely. From my point of view, the superdeterminism is really difficult to believe in. I think the idea that nature would be like that just seems a little too constraining. I find it a little bit distasteful. Mind matter duality, on the other hand, I would put a fairly high credence in that. It seems to me that we need something radical to explain consciousness. I don't think that ultimately the materialist account is going to work. So something like panpsychism or mind matter duality, I think ultimately will be the right way forward, or maybe something I haven't imagined yet. There's also idealism, which is the idea that the world is made out of our thoughts, pretty much. In fact, I've wondered if, Marcus, what your sort of approach, I wonder which of these categories it fits into. It might even be the idealist category, yeah. So maybe that's the way forward, that we construct the world out of our own thoughts. In any case, I think something radical is needed, and so we should be open to radical possibilities. From my point of view, I would say, I'm claiming that the probability of a positive result where quantum theory is violated is about 3%. A lot of people think that's crazy and would give a much, much lower number. But whatever the number is, you know, as long as it's not vanishingly small, like even if it was 1 in 1 million, 1 in 10 million, I think the probability times the payoff, the payoff for our understanding of the world, is still very high. You know? And in any case, people are looking for experiments to perform. So I think it is worthwhile doing that. Okay. Another point is this. Often people say that Cartesian dualism is not a valid scientific point of view. Okay, it's not valid scientifically to invoke sort of non-physical mind. But first of all, of course, one should understand, although one is saying that the mind is non-physical, that's really just terminology. It's still ontologically real. This experiment would show that we can address the issue of dualism scientifically. So it takes this kind of experiment demonstrates that that you can't actually talk about these issues in scientific terms. There's an experiment. So even just as a thought experiment, and even if the experiment was done, but it turned out not to be, to satisfy quantum theory, as probably everyone expects, nevertheless, it's valuable to have thought experiments that allow you to investigate these kinds of ideas. Okay, so I have a few minutes left.
You started later, so you can...
Oh, okay, right, okay. Well, then let me... this is some more technical stuff I didn't put in the talk last week that I thought would be interesting here. So here's the sort of picture we have. We have end A, end B. We have an intervention, so a human presumably making a switch event, which affects the actual setting at some point. And then the measurement at end A has been... And then information about this switch event travels out over here. And if the measurement at end B happens before this information reaches it, then the locality condition is satisfied. So the retarded setting, well, let me just explain in words. The retarded setting is the setting that NB can deduce from the hidden state at this point, okay? So if there's no intervention, then the setting will take a certain value. And that's, you can determine that from the sort of hidden state of the switching apparatus here. And so that's the retarded setting. So one can put a bit more flesh on that. If you let the state of the switch box at a certain time be alpha t, then you can calculate alpha t by some deterministic function from the switch time, from this hidden state at time alpha zero. We imagine that time zero is the last time a light speed signal can communicate the state of the machine NB to the measurement event NB. Okay. So this is just mathematizing what I just said in words. If an intervention happens, then the state of the switching machine at some time T prime, then the state of the system subsequently times T prime and later is not what it would be given by this function. What we mean by the retarded setting, well, the setting is calculated as a function of the initials of the original state. So the future state of the setting is given by some function of the initial state. So the retarded setting is the setting that you would calculate were it not for this intervention. So this retarded setting is something in principle, if you understand what your interventions are, is something in principle that you can know. So one way to know it would be to leave the apparatus static and only switch it when there is an intervention. Or another way to know it would be to have it moving randomly, but somehow, or have it moving deterministically, but somehow predict what it's going to be. So the retarded setting is actually something that you could have as something you could know in your experiment. And so now we can derive Bell's inequalities with retarded settings. So the setting at NB can be influenced by, the outcome at NB can be influenced by the setting at NB, the retarded value at NB, the retarded value from end A, and some hidden variables, and likewise at the other side. So you can derive Bell inequalities in the usual kind of way. So you take this mathematical result, you put in some particular choices. Notice all these choices have the same retarded settings, but different, potentially different actual settings. So you substitute these in, so there you integrate over lambda, and you get these retarded Bell inequalities. So the thing to notice about this is if you want the actual settings to be equal to the retarded settings, then each term in here ends up being equal. So you just get 2 times E, okay, because you have the term plus the term plus the term minus the term. So 2 times E. And since the logical upper value for E is equal to 1, then obviously this inequality has to be satisfied. Also, actually, if the setting is only different at one end, you can also show that the inequality is satisfied. So you really need it to make this inequality work. It needs to be different at both ends. So one thing you can do is build an actual model that takes advantage of these retarded settings. So in the model here, I haven't bothered to take advantage of the local retarded setting since it seems irrelevant, just the distant retarded setting. So here's a model. You define some hidden variable, lambda. This one is distributed over from 0 to 2 pi. It's an angle. And we imagine it wraps around. We have a flat distribution over lambda. And then we define it, in certain ranges, we define a to be equal to plus 1 and minus 1 according to these ranges. The details I don't think are very important. So it's easy to prove, the way I've chosen these ranges, that this correlation function is 1 minus this linear expression here in these angles. So if you want to reproduce quantum theory, you just put these angles that appeared earlier equal to certain expressions, and then what you obtain is this. Okay, these are the retarded settings. And now if the retarded settings are equal to the actual settings, then you get the standard quantum result. This is in agreement with quantum theory. Well, one thing that's interesting about this model, and it raises a certain question, is that even if the setting is only different at one end, so imagine if A is equal to AR, A is equal to the retarded setting is equal to the actual setting, but BR is different from B, then you violate this model violates quantum theory. And so so in this particular model, you would only need to impose the causality conditions at one end, not at both ends. And it does raise a question, can you prove that would be true in any model? It seems unlikely, but but there is an extra constraint here. So we know from existing experiments that when the actual and retarded settings are equal, you have to get the quantum predictions. So we have that constraint on our models. And so it's conceivable that with that constraint, any model would have to have this property that if the settings are even different on one end, I'm not sure what that question mark is doing there, then you would see a violation of quantum theory. So I've been thinking about trying to prove that. I think it's unlikely, but it's just something one should investigate. If that were true, it'd be much easier to do the experiment. You'd get a much higher rate of imposing the causality condition just one direction. Okay, well, some discussion. Seems like it's just about feasible, this experiment. It would open up this field of brain quantum interface experiments where we use the brain to, through EEG, to intervene in a quantum experiment. It's unlikely, I think, that quantum theory will be violated, but sufficiently high probability that it's worth doing the experiment. It's interesting, actually, to talk about probabilities over the space of theories. It really doesn't make any sense to talk about probabilities over the space of theories. It's just one sort of gut feelings we're talking about. It would be a very significant result if quantum theory was violated. If it was violated, we'd want to perform more, future experiments using more and more complex systems. And, maybe not just humans, but penguins as well. So I had a chance to talk to Roger at this conference. He was there last week. And Sir Roger Penrose. I'll give him his full title. And he told me that there'd been this rumor that he has a penguin, and he has a pet penguin, and it was on Wikipedia. And then eventually, some fact checkers realized that this wasn't true, and they took it off Wikipedia. And so he was kind of sad to lose his penguin. And at one point, he asked some students, said, "Well, we could put it back on Wikipedia." So they did, and it was there for a little while. Then again, it got taken off again. So I'm hoping to get the rumor going again. So here's definite evidence that he has it. There's Percy, So that will hopefully get the rumor going again. So the question, of course, is if we have humans, like even very very smart humans, we could also just we could try penguins and go down through the animals. What about plants? Consider all sorts of wacky ideas. Okay, right. I'll stop there. Thank you.
So, just trying to get a handle on what you mean by violating quantum theory.
Right.
So, if you had, say, you set up an experiment with the settings at whatever it is that gives you the maximum violation.
Yeah.
So, you run that with sort of standard random number generators and you get the maximum violation.
Yeah.
Is the idea then to replace the random number generators with human beings?
Yeah, yeah.
Then see what happens to that.
Yeah.
Would you expect to go from the maximum violation to two,
In the case where, well, this was true, first of all, which is maybe not likely, but if it were true, and also you impose the locality conditions in 100% of cases. And actually, I think a slightly better experiment would be where you record. So you do the experiment with humans, and you record the input into the setting device. Okay, just the electrical signals that goes into the setting device, and so record that on tape or whatever people record things on nowadays, and then play it back. Because when you play it back, it would be the same electrical signal going into the setting device, but it wouldn't. The locality conditions would no longer be satisfied. So if this were true, you'd expect quantum theory to be violated. Sorry, in the first case where humans are used, but not in the second case where just recordings are used.
But then. So it seems like it's starting from the position that non-conscious things can generate the true randomness that's needed for the settings, but as soon as you bring humans in, they're not random enough.
No, that's not the point at all. It's not so much about randomness, it's about having interventions. It's about making the setting sort of unexpected at the end. If I'm trying to impose locality conditions, So Marcus doesn't know what the setting is over here. The main thing is I just change it in a way that he can't predict at the last second. It's not about some certification for randomness, but just about an intervention so that he doesn't know what the setting is.
I'm trying to get to that when you what you're testing for in human beings is whether they're predictable in a way that
whether they're not predictable.
Yes, but starting from the idea that you can make a device out of stuff that isn't human beings that is completely unpredictable.
That is completely... Oh. Okay, so predictable and deterministic, of course, are different concepts.
Yeah.
I don't understand your question. The point is really, can you impose the locality conditions? And to do that, everyone thinks we need to switch so that the other side can't know. But the problem is, if you switch with some device which is fundamentally deterministic, then the other side can know at the fundamental level. And so we want to use something which is a candidate for not being deterministic. At the physical level, and that would be the humans. Maybe we can talk.
Yeah, let's.
Yeah. I've got a question about your locality condition. So it seems to me, I mean, that it might not even be necessary to get the result, because in the extreme case that the mind duality holds, mm-hmm. so that if a human makes the switches, then you would not get, and you would get value inequalities.
Yeah.
To satisfy the value inequalities. Then I don't see why it's. I mean, you could also imagine that you would get better inequalities even if you do the experiment just on a tabletop, two people sitting across each other, even without imposing any locality conditions. Because in that case, quantum mechanics, the ordinary quantum mechanics experiment, would give you better inequality violations. Mm-hmm. That wouldn't just give you any strong evidence for non-locality and things, because you have all kinds of loopholes. But if you if humans' mind switching actually destroys the quantum effects and basically gives you very good violations, then it could just as well happen on the tabletop.
So suddenly it's
much,
true.
Much easier experiment.
Suddenly it's true that you could do the experiment and you know in some models you would predict a violation of quantum theory, but there also exist models where you would satisfy quantum theory because the information could spread. Right, at the speed of light, and so it would be available at each end.
Yes, yeah. But if you look for this very, very important exciting result, then you could just start with the
lab. Sure, you could start there, yeah. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. There's no reason not to do the experiment there, and maybe that's a good preliminary test. But it wouldn't provide... it seems to me... So first of all, it's unlikely that this is true. You know, it's difficult to imagine. But if it were true, then when they want to start, so what sort of models are true? And I think it seems to me that the most likely models where it spreads out at the speed of light, but it may not. It may the information may spread out much more slowly. In which case, the sort of test you're talking about might work. Yeah.
Okay, I just have a quick remark on the picture, the Descartes picture you showed at the beginning. I think this is the pineal gland on the picture, and
oh, good.
I believe that it was the seat of consciousness because it was in the symmetry plane of the brain, so it exists only once and not twice.
Let me just go back to that picture. So, there we are.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's the.
So they assume the seat of consciousness to be there. This gland is exactly in the symmetry.
Oh right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so that's what this is about. I was hoping for some sort of mind floating above
yes.
the picture, but I couldn't find that. Yeah.
But maybe the second question. So, what do you think about these works? I guess you know by Hofstadter, Douglas Hofstadter, I'm a Strange Loop. So this kind of explanation or trying to okay. see consciousness as just emerging from a certain complexity of computation.
So I mean, I'm not as familiar with that as I should be. And I'm not a philosopher, so we don't have the subtlety here.
I'm not a philosopher.
Right, but there are philosophers in the audience, so be careful. I think the hard problem is a really difficult thing to overcome. On the one hand, on the other hand, you know, the past has shown us we have to be humble. You know, you can never know for sure what sort of explanations will emerge, and it's conceivable that some very compelling sort of materialist explanation will emerge for consciousness that we just couldn't anticipate. So we should always remain open to that.
So would you say that if Hofstadter is right, then there would be no violation of quantum?
Yeah, if it's an entirely materialist explanation, then there wouldn't be a compelling case for a violation of quantum theory.
Right.
It's still possible there would be, and some other reason, but
because of what you said, like high complexity.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that kind of explanation doesn't seem very good to me, but yeah.
I wanted to, so I'm not really clear on what you're trying to find in the EEG signal. I mean, so what do the humans actually have to do? They just think, switch, or?
Yeah, so you'd want them to be involved in an appropriate sort of thinky behavior or choicey behavior. So maybe they would actually be doing switching or typing.
Do you need an independent way to know when the switch?
Yeah, these are difficult questions. So, like if you had a big distance to play with, if you could afford the sort of the microseconds, then you could use one of these algorithms they use to tell what buttons people are going to press on a typewriter, and use that, you know, to feed it into your switching. But these kinds of things, you know, that you're talking about, you know, that's 1/10 of a second ahead, but there's really sort of something like 100 milliseconds it takes to distinguish these EEG signals.
But why do you need a physical signal? I mean, why isn't it enough to have people in the room just think switch, for example? Like, well, why do you need it to?
Well, you want the switch to be changed. I mean, you want the switch.
But, I mean, shouldn't the fact that they're in the light cone of the?
Oh, you're still wearing the headset though. Yeah.
But what difference does it make if they wear the headset or if they just think it, like, with
cone? You want there to be a physical connection between what they think and the switch actually being changed.
Right, but wouldn't that be the case if they're thinking it in the... So if they're...
Yeah.
If it's determined... So it's a matter of being in the light cone also of the other device, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, physics background is a long time ago, but, like... So if enough people just think that they want to switch it, like, now, shouldn't that, if it's within the past light cone, shouldn't the switch already... I don't see why the EEG signal is different than just, like, passing through air to the device or something. I mean, how do... Because you need a threshold, but the threshold is something physical that you don't... people don't know what corresponds to a conscious decision in the EEG signal, right?
So there's lots of issues here. So first of all, I think you do need a physical connection between people's brain activity and the switch setting. So you're trying to impose that the apparatus is changed by this phenomena.
My point is you do have a physical connection even if you don't hook them up.
It's true that you could imagine a situation in which the initial state of the switch setting was, you know, this hidden state I'm talking about, was so incredibly sensitive that even just having people nearby would be enough.
Right.
That's conceivable, but let's force it, make it so they actually change the setting, so then we know that we're doing a bit better than just, you know, these models. So, but then the question is, you know, what signals in the brain correspond to conscious choices and what are just, you know, other processing? And of course, that's...
But that's it doesn't mean like you have to solve the problem beforehand to impose that threshold, right? So, like, if you don't know what corresponds to the conscious decision, then you can't take that physical state to switch your device. So you...
It's just about increasing the likelihood that you're finding the effect. And so, neuroscientists... you said there's some neuroscientists in the room. you are, right, good, excellent, right. So neuroscientists like yourself... I've spent time thinking about what processes in the brain correspond to conscious activity and which don't and so on. And so so using that kind of study, we could try to increase the chances that we're causing the switch to be changed by conscious choices. The other idea is, one idea I have for maximizing the chance, because you don't need to know that the switch happened when it happened. You just need it to be a sufficiently high number of cases that there was an intervention at each end, and so the locality conditions were satisfied. One idea I have is to send sort of EEG signals through what I'm calling an ultra-fast electronic hashing device. So usually people talk about hashing in the cryptographic sense, that you want to send you want to have it, the input. So the very, very similar inputs will lead to very distinct outputs in a sort of hashing. So I'm not really interested in the cryptographic aspect of that, but just quickly separating very, very, very close signals in the EEG so that they lead to very different settings. So you're sort of maximizing any chance of seeing this thing. So that's one idea for some of the appropriate electronic pre-processing of the signal before it turns into the operators. So that's a... There's a whole area there that I think I need to think about, and I need to talk to people who have expertise.
It's actually a leg up doing this. I sorry for interrupting the order. I just want to say something that's directly related to it. I think that, like regards to in relation to your question, like one can actually take the opposite logic and one can say like, okay, let's see how much we get on violation, how we can infer, like, you know, usually we infer, like, there's this idea of inferring causality from like various, you know, like breaking correlation, you know, like properties and so on and so on. And here I can say, okay, like the conscious decision is actually something that we can indicate by having this this level of inequalities, and like this is this type of like something being like actually like conscious decision has been made. And I think that like actually like this what you the idea with using EEG is like I find it amazing because well there is like all this question like which type of brain waves correspond to like you know like frequency ranges I mean to what type of modality of consciousness. And in principle like here you said that like consciousness is like it's just used as a term, yeah, but like it's not differentiated into like different what consciousness could be. And like for example, one could say one could think that like different ranges of brain waves, like theta, beta, alpha, and so on, they actually like different forms of consciousness. And so like one could actually try to do those experiments with separately with different brainwave ranges. And what if one would get different violations? Like and in such case, like this could be, you know, used for for like inferring what actually like is a what does it mean to make a conscious decision at certain ranges of brainwaves?
I mean, in the first place, to impose in the causality conditions, you have so little time to play with, because the separation of 1,000 kilometers between the two ends gives you what does that translate into? I've forgotten now. That's sort of like a millisecond or something. So you haven't got any time to. Whereas you know these different frequencies are you know measured more like in sort of hertz and tens of hertz, so you haven't got much time. 50 hertz, I think, is you know, some of these alpha. I forget the ranges of the different frequencies, but so you haven't really got time to resolve the frequency before you send it in. But maybe you can do some post processing and analyze that. But it's yeah.
If the like typical like curve patterns, one can like preselect some pattern of the curve and try to do fast Fourier only on this.
Yeah. So suddenly one can try these things, but it's yeah.
So yeah, so in light of the time, there are a couple more questions, but let's maybe postpone them to the coffee break. So let's thank Lucien again.
Thank you.